We continue now with excerpts of the CME Satellite Symposium, beginning with the controversial case I discussed with Dr. Smith, a 63-year-old man who presented in August 2009 with a lung mass that was initially thought to be lung cancer and then diagnosed as follicular lymphoma, as discussed by the treating oncologist, Dr. Lowell Hart.
This gentleman initially had a bronchoscopy, which was inconclusive, then had a mediastinoscopy and biopsy, which did show follicular lymphoma. The PET scan was negative outside the thorax, and he was started on treatment with bendamustine and rituximab and started to feel a lot better at the start. He had significant improvement after 3 cycles. We repeated some of his scans. He had some complications of some cough and some post-obstructive pneumonia, which cleared with antibiotics, and he continued on treatment, again, tolerated his treatment well, continued decrease in the size of the mass and improvement in symptoms. He still has some residual mass and some post-obstructive signs on his scans, which we'll review. He's now on maintenance rituximab. Since he did develop some hypogammaglobulinemia, he's also receiving IV gammaglobulin.
And any questions you'd like to see the faculty discuss, Lowell?
Well, there's a few questions. I forgot to mention, we did give him some consolidative radiation therapy to the site of his initial bulky mass in the thorax, which he tolerated quite well. But that's one question about the role of that in a follicular lymphoma with an initial bulky presentation. Also, the dose of bendamustine that's used, I think in the experience of myself and a lot of practicing physicians, that the 120 per meter squared might be, especially for a large-sized gentleman like this, a little bit higher than we may actually need. I'd like to know what the faculty thinks about that, as well as the role of maintenance rituximab.
Dr. Rumble, have you seen patients present with FL that look like they had lung cancer like this?
Very rarely this happens. This is, of course, a not common setting of the disease. But as we know, the lymphoma can have a manifestation in nearly every organ, yes. Of course, by chance, you would not see ever a low-grade lymphoma in the brain, but in all other tissues, I have seen them.
I'm just curious from the faculty, again, what your experience is with FL, Stephanie, presenting, you know, in sort of an unusual manner. And also, what about Dr. Hart's question about the consolidation radiation in this situation, Stephanie?
Yeah, it's very unusual to see this kind of a bulky mass, stage one bulky follicular, essentially. I didn't hear about a bone marrow examination, but very unusual presentation. I think many people have given consolidative radiotherapy to patients with bulky masses. You know, there's not proof that it does anything to overall survival. Maybe it prevents relapse. I think that that's not always routinely done in the low-grade lymphomas.
Dave?
Well, I'd be concerned that this is actually follicular lymphoma. I didn't see any convincing evidence that it was follicular lymphoma. I would have probably gone in for a bigger piece of tissue, and I would want to ask the question from the radiologist, what was the SUV uptake on the PET scan? And if it was in the 10 to 20 range, that would be much more consistent with an aggressive lymphoma.
So Dr. Rodriguez, do we have a PET scan on him?
We do. I don't have those numbers, but just looking at the images, most of the activity was actually in the lung and not within the mass and the mediastinum and hilum. So I would guess that the numbers would be low.
Yes, I also would ask for the LDH. If the LDH would be very high, I also would agree to David Maloney that I would ask for a larger biopsy of the tumor mass because this could be reasonable doubt that it's a follicular lymphoma.
And what would you be thinking if it's not FL?
Diffuse large B-cell.
Myron?
I guess one other concern would be even with the small biopsy that was obtained, it could be that transformed lymphoma could be lying within that large tumor mass. And at this point in time, I probably would have chosen R-CHOP versus bendamustine rituximab as my upfront therapy, unless there are predisposing issues with cardiotoxicity for that patient. And the other issue is I've seen cases like this. I actually had a Jehovah's Witness that I treated and had almost his whole lung was replaced with tumor, follicular lymphoma. He received 8 cycles of R-CHOP. I did consolidate with radiation, and it was a few years ago. At this time, I probably would have given him 2 years of maintenance rituximab as well.
Stephanie?
Was there an LDH? Did we hear that?
LDH, Lowell, and did you do a bone marrow?
I did not do a bone marrow in the patient. The LDH was not significantly elevated when he first presented.
I want to pick up on some of the questions that Dr. Hart asked, but one he asked related to the question of dose. And actually, we asked the audience in general, how would they approach dosing of a patient, 63-year-old patient like this one with BR? and it's kind of split between day one and two, every 3 weeks, every 4 weeks. Stephanie, in our recent patterns of care survey that you helped us design, we saw a lot of homogeneity in the investigators who are using 90 every 28 days, but incredible heterogeneity in the community. I mean, virtually every one of these answers is almost similar. What do you think is happening, and how do you think people should approach this, Stephanie?
Yeah, I think the answer is really not in, except we know that 120 milligram per meter squared days one and two is not the correct dose. It's the FDA-approved dose. It was based on the 100 patients that were done in relapsed rituximab refractory patients. And I think that most of us are more in the area of the 90 milligram per meter squared when adding it with rituximab frontline. And certainly if you're talking about CLL, there are different doses that have been recommended. So I would not use the 120 milligram per meter squared.
What about the actual selection of treatment, Mitch? For example, BR in this concluding slide, I think you said is the standard of care. I've heard the term a standard of care. What have you been doing since the last ASH meeting in terms of this?
Yeah, I would qualify my answer first to echo what my colleague said, as I would be concerned to make sure that there's no transformation underlying large cell. But that being said, you know, the data with BR are pretty solid, and I think it is A, not the standard of care. It's certainly a reasonable choice. I don't think there is one standard. You can get there in many ways because the endpoint is PFS, and what we really want to know is OS in the long-term overall survival. So it's nice to have the patient in disease-free state longer, but, you know, in the long run, BR, what happens with second treatment, there are lots of questions. So I think it's certainly a reasonable treatment. I use it a lot, but I don't think you can fault someone for using one of the older regimens.
Dave, you had a comment?
Well, I would not have chosen BR for this patient. I would have given him R-CHOP. And I mean, I think it's extremely unusual for a follicular lymphoma to be 10 plus centimeters in size and not have systemic disease. I mean, it's just extremely unusual. Like, I can't say that it wouldn't happen. If this was a large cell lymphoma, then we think that an anthracycline is the most important component of that treatment, and we would certainly have used an R-CHOP. So I probably would have defaulted, in the absence of the histology really being completely clear, to R-CHOP rather than treating a typical follicular lymphoma. So I have just difference of opinion, but that's how I do it.
And let's just say it was difficult to get more tissue, so, quote, you're maybe covering yourself a little bit, but what about maintenance then, Dave, in that situation?
I would give maintenance for 2 years because I think the PRIMA study is pretty clear that that decreases the risk of relapse of follicular lymphoma.
So, Jonathan, I'm curious of your thoughts about those PRIMA data and how it affected you, but we also try to kind of push it to the next level. Now, this trial you're doing, a 2 versus 4, has actually been going on for, what, about a year and a half. You started before PRIMA was presented, right?
Yes, it was anticipating the results of the PRIMA trial, and we have now 600 patients included within 20 months, so we will find the answer in the future. But we need a lot of time to answer this question.
I love it. And this is all out of Germany. Incredible. So, Jonathan, we pose the situation to the audience. You have a patient, you know, who's got BR as induction, has a CR, goes through 2 years of maintenance, and at 2 years is doing fine, no problems. How would you approach the issue of continuation? Actually, about a third of the audience would either offer or actually recommend continuation. Of course, we don't have any data. Matthias, the study is going to give us that. What do you think about these answers?
I would be very cautious about continuing rituximab in this setting until we get more data. The risk of toxicity might evolve over time. And some of the toxicities that have been reported with rituximab at very low levels, sinopulmonary infections, more devastating things like PML, hepatitis reactivation, the immunosuppression that you might see with prolonged maintenance could evolve to be more of a problem. I hope it's not true. I think the trials that Matthias suggested are very important, but at the present time, without more firm data, I think that it's important to strongly consider stopping rituximab after 2 years.
Myron, you had a comment?
A couple comments. One, this patient already receiving IVIG because they had hypogammaglobulinemia. I think there's an issue that you should question whether you should stop rituximab sooner than 2 years. Second point is that, as we mentioned, Dr. Maloney and I don't often agree with each other, but we agree in our CHOP in a bulky patient with symptomatic disease, and we're not sure. The other question I should ask is that this patient, I don't know if they're really in a complete remission at the point of completion of therapy. And this patient's only 63 and otherwise healthy, could still be a candidate for an autologous stem cell transplant. And then the issue of what therapy we're using up front may play a role in whether or not we can collect stem cells down the line.
So Lowell, maybe we can just finish up and pick up on a couple of points that have come up here. Maybe you can go into a little bit more about what happened with the infection, when it occurred, and how you approached it. I'm also curious what you think about the faculty's thought that maybe this really wasn't FL, Lowell.
Well, I definitely would respectfully disagree with giving the patient our CHOP. I think that our bendamustine has done a great job with this patient. I'm very convinced by Dr. Rummel's study where it actually beat our CHOP. It didn't just tie it, it beat it in follicular lymphoma. So I think that the patient has done great. I think he did have one post-obstructive pneumonia early on in his treatment that responded nicely to antibiotics. He's had no further infections and is back working as a prison guard, pretty much 100% performance status. He's due to get a follow-up PET scan. His PET scan has continued to improve, all the ones that we've gotten subsequently. He's due for another one after the holidays. I actually saw him in the office 2 days ago, and he's feeling perfect. So I'm comfortable with how he was treated, and I think he's done very well. So I would, respectfully disagree that our CHOP, a regimen that I remember from medical school, is the treatment of choice for this patient. I think, as someone who treats a lot of breast cancer, we're moving away from anthracyclines, and I think it's time to move away from them in lymphomas as much as we can also.
Yeah, Matthias, we sort of joke with some of the oncologists that BR is the new TC, docetaxel cyclophosphamide, and breast cancer is Lowell, and all oncologists know, kind of moved in, and BR seemed to have done the same thing. Lowell, what about to get more tissue? How was the tissue obtained, and how difficult would it have been to get more tissue?
Well, this was a mediastinoscopy. I mean, in practice, you have to deal with the tissue as it comes out as it's obtained by the thoracic surgeons. Yes, it would have been nicer. I'm sure Dr. Levine would have preferred to see an extra big chunk of tissue, but whether it's worthwhile to go back and do another invasive procedure on a patient after the first one immediately, I don't know.
We'll just close out with Dr. Levine. Any thoughts about this issue of, could this have been diffuse large B-cell? What are your thoughts?
Yes, in fact, we can't exclude that. The material we had did not contain any intact node, nor could we even recognize nodal tissue. It was more or less just a tissue infiltrate of the smaller component of cells. It was signed out simply as a CD20 positive B-cell lymphoma. It was the flow cytometry, which we fortunately did do, that suggested that it was consistent with a follicular center cell signature, which is why that was advanced, and that is in the report. But clearly, we often see transformation and larger cell components along with this, and it's a possibility, but we're basing our diagnosis on the material we received.
Matthias, what do we know about BR and diffuse large B-cell?
Not too much. We have done, of course, a sub-analysis in our study, patients with a low LDH and a high LDH, because also we speculate that maybe some of the patients are underdiagnosed with this aggressive histology. And we found out that even in the higher LDH patient population, the bendamustine rituximab was clearly not inferior, but still this was, as it was presented in this case, primarily a follicular lymphoma with a high LDH in which you could speculate. For diffuse large B-cell lymphomas, we will await soon some studies from other countries in the world.